and welcome to the Dorothy Project. Today, I'm talking to a veteran fundraiser and activist from the States, one of so many women's perspectives on the AIDS crisis. Victoria Noe is funny and warm, and she left me so inspired by her insight that everyone can do something. Definitely a message I think we need right now.
Your book has such a like grabby title. So
I'm so glad you said that. Today, I just got a critique from a contest, and they hated the title. They thought it was offensive. I should have picked something more likable.
Do you know what? I was actually going to ask you about that. I think we had a conversation on Twitter where about the term fag hag.
Right.
Which I, like, full disclosure, I personally don't like. So I'd love to get your take on it.
Well, the title of the book popped into my head when I first started working on the book. And I kept thinking, oh, I can't use that. No one will like it, you know? So every time I interviewed a woman from the book, I'd say, don't worry, we're going to change the title. And every single one would say, why? That's me. You know, I've been a fag hag for, you know, it's like, I'm not offended by that. So I decided if they weren't offended, then I didn't care if anybody else was.
Yeah.
Sort of. And honestly, it's been men who have been offended by the title.
That's interesting. Gay men specifically, or?
Yes, pretty much, not entirely, but pretty much, yeah.
And what was that? I would never want to assume like the reasons why someone doesn't like something. So what have they tended to say?
Well, they didn't get past the first word.
Yeah.
That, you know, fag. And I had a couple of instances on websites where they censored the word. They put an asterisk instead of the A. And they said, it's an offensive word. And I said, not with my friends, you know, because my gay friends are not offended by that word. You know, there's the whole movement of taking back names that have been used as slurs. And that was what the women I interviewed really showed me, was that we're taking this back. You know, you might think this is a derogatory term, but we're flying the flag. So.
And so your book is an amazing like compendium of different women, like everyone from Princess Diana to kind of community organizers.
Exactly. And yeah.
It's kind of like what I've been doing. Like, how did you begin to find those women and to tell their stories?
Well, I mean, it was really, I've been in and out of the AIDS community since the late 80s. So I knew some stories, but really a teeny fraction of what's in the book I already knew. Most of that I was learning as I was researching and interviewing women. But when I got the idea for the book in April 2014, and I tried to talk myself out of writing the book because I was sure someone had already done this. And in September of 2015, I decided, okay, I'll do this. And I was on Facebook late one night, and I put out a message in the AIDS groups that I'm a member of and said, I'm thinking about writing this book. I still wasn't 100%. I'm thinking about writing this book. Do you know any women I should interview or archives I should go to? And within 5 minutes, my phone was chiming. And the messages didn't just come from mostly gay men, some lesbians that I knew. It came from strangers. And probably half the referrals that I got over the course of working on the book were from strangers. And they just felt like, this is important. Someone needs to do this. You need to do this. And this woman needs to be in the book. I'm still getting comments from people. Why isn't this woman in your book? It's like, well, I had to stop somewhere.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of women I interviewed who are not in the book. So I couldn't fit everyone in. But to me, that shows that there's such, I don't want to say an untapped market, that sounds too businesslike, but there's a whole group of women out there with important stories to tell who have not had that opportunity.
And I totally agree. And why do you think that they haven't been told before now?
Well, you know, with all due respect to my gay friends who have made documentaries and written memoirs and everything, it's like there has always been a real ownership of the AIDS epidemic. That it started, you know, with gay men, mostly white gay men, and they were by default the public face of the epidemic, at least in the first 15 years. And even if you ask someone now, what do you think of when you think of AIDS? They think of those photos of emaciated men. And the truth is there were women involved. There are certainly women with HIV, women who died of AIDS from the beginning, very early on. And there were women involved in the community. Lesbians did amazing work from the very beginning. They were part of the community. Straight women like me were not part of that community, the LGBT community. We came into it, which was often viewed with suspicion as to our motives to being there. And there were a lot of scams. I mean, I remember there were a lot of people coming in, you know, with a real religious fervor, and they were going to convert these people, and, you know, before they died, you know, there were all kinds of things like that going on. You know, the suspicion was justified, I think, at least the beginning.
I hadn't even thought of that. So there were people who were coming in and like evangelizing and trying.
Sure. Well, and not just evangelizing, but it was, you know, the whole thing of, you know, when someone with AIDS would die, they would be denied the last rites in the Catholic Church. They would be denied Christian burials. And, you know, and there were a couple of stories in the book around that whole idea of churches refusing to bury people. And so organized religion, you know, is not a traditionally been a big friend to the AIDS community. And it was all rooted in homophobia, whether it was the black churches in Harlem in New York, or whether it was small communities in rural areas, it didn't matter. It was homophobia that was all around a lot of this, and also condemnation of the drug culture. You know, everything's connected. Everything's connected. There's no issue or solution that's simple.
What did draw you in then as a straight woman?
Well, I came from a theater background. I have 2 degrees in theater. And, you know, so I, high school, college, and afterwards when I was working professionally, I was surrounded by gay men. And I was doing fundraising in the mid-80s. And, you know, I started off with arts organizations, and then as the decade, by 1988, 89, it was all AIDS fundraising. And it stayed that way till 94, when I burned out and dropped out of the AIDS community for a while. But it was just always part, gay men have always been part of my life. And, you know, I dated a couple, and, you know, one of whom came out while we were dating. And, you know, we remained friends for 46 years. He died a couple months ago.
Wow.
And, you know, it was, we were just the best of friends.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me reading, you know, reading what you've written in interviews is the way that you talk about kind of coming back to the AIDS community fairly recently.
Yes.
And, yeah. Uncovering a well of anger. Like how has that been for you?
Well, about 8 years ago now, Tracy Baim, who was a publisher of Windy City Times, the local LGBT paper here, I've known her for 30 years. And she was doing a weekly series called AIDS at 30, because it was the 30th anniversary of the first article in the New York Times about the epidemic. And she asked me if I wanted to write one of the weekly reflections. And I was sure I wouldn't remember anything. I'm like, that's a long time ago, but I'll try. And I sat down at the computer and I started typing, and I could not keep up. My fingers were moving so fast. And and the anger just surged in me. And I had not felt that anger about the epidemic for a long time. And it scared me. Honestly, it scared me because it came on so suddenly. And I was starting to work on a series of little books about people grieving the death of a friend. And one of the books was about losing friends to AIDS. So I had to really go back and confront all those memories when I was writing that. And when it came out in 2013, I went to my first ACT UP meeting in New York. And, I think it was about the third meeting, they said, why did you join, blah, blah, blah. And I said, because I haven't been arrested yet, and I think I'm way past you. And I still haven't been arrested yet. But, it's... When I was fundraising, in 1989, I didn't have time to march. I didn't have time to do protests. I was spending, every waking minute really raising money for programs for people with AIDS. And I couldn't do it then. But what I realize now, and certainly in the course of writing this latest book, is that there are all different forms of activism. And that maybe it's stuffing envelopes in an organization's office for a fundraising mailing. Maybe it's writing a grant application. Maybe it's getting arrested in the street, but there are all kinds of different ways that, you can do that, And I was and continue to be in that odd situation of being partway in the community and partway out. And it's just the way I just accepted it over the years. And it's just, and the women in the book talk about that too, we could go home at night and separate ourselves from what was going on. The lesbians in the community could not do that. And, that was both a blessing and a curse, I think. And, I'm very careful about sort of maintaining my position, and not imposing myself on things.
We were talking about ACT UP. What form does that take now? Because I've read How to Survive a Plague, and that's such a vivid picture of ACT UP in the 80s and 90s. But what does it look like in 2013 or 2019?
Well, if you watch David Francis' documentary, How to Survive a Plague, there are, like 200 or 300 people in a meeting. There are not 200 or 300 people in a meeting. That urgency is gone, at least the meetings I've been to. But you will find 20 or 30 people there. It's a more diverse crowd than you saw in the documentaries, both racially, ethnically, and gender-wise. A college student asked me after a screening of the documentary, I didn't hear anybody talking about trans people. I'm like, we didn't even use that word in 1989. But it's a very different crowd as far as diversity now than you saw then. They are as passionate and as hardworking as ever. They are doing as much good as ever. Their numbers are just smaller. But they're just as loud and raucous and creative as ever. There's a new ACT UP. There's an ACT UP chapter in London. There's one in Dublin, there's a new one in Cork, Paris, several cities in the U.S. And what I've been noticing in the last couple of years is that there are new chapters coming up. And I haven't seen new chapters in a really long time. So I think that that's very indicative of the realization that we're coming up on 40 years and we're still doing this. And there's a lot of work to be done. There are more tools in the toolbox, but we need to get back to work. And that's why you're seeing these new chapters come up.
Two things that struck me there, I guess. The first is that's really interesting that you say that about trans people, because obviously, so I'm 33, so I wasn't there at the time, but have been watching the TV show Pose.
Yes.
Obviously, the trans community, big part of that, trans people of color also being affected by HIV. Do you think that maybe they were being affected, but were not necessarily in the conversation, in the media?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Right. They were not in the conversation. Women in general were not in the conversation. It was a very, you know, it was a very targeted demographic that you saw publicly, you know, that you saw at fundraising events, that you saw on news stories on TV or in the papers. It was a very narrow definition. Even as, you know, I remember in 1990, I was working for an organization that served men and women with HIV and AIDS, and how shocking that was to people that there were women there. It's like, of course there are women here. Why wouldn't there be women here? But that was the perception, and to a large extent, it's still the perception. But, you know, the gay community, we like to think that the LGBT community is welcoming to all. And there are people within the LGBT community who are, you know, sexist and misogynistic and, you know, all those isms, and, you know, and because they're human, and it can be a little depressing when you sort of think that they're sort of better than that, but we're just who we are.
Yeah, so. I know. That's the thing, isn't it? It's always like less helpful to have such, I don't know. We're all people, right? And people are flawed, and society is patriarchal and racist, and so in terms of like the resurgence of ACT UP, and I've actually interviewed someone who's part of the Dublin chapter, the first season of the podcast. So you were talking about the work that needs to be done. What do you see as the work that needs doing right now?
Well, I mean, we're still trying to get women included in clinical trials for drugs. We should not still have to be fighting about that.
Wow.
You know, that should not be an issue anymore. We're still fighting to try to get the trans community represented, not just in clinical trials, but in legislation, in policies, in all kinds of regulation. You know, they're just, you know, there are too many people who just do the first two letters of LGBT, you know, it's lesbian or gay, and then that's it. And so, you know, there's a movement, you know, a lot of movement I see, you know, with making sure that there is equal representation, and also that people don't continue to think of AIDS as an urban issue. It affects everybody in every community, whether it's a big city or a small town or a rural community. It doesn't matter. It does not matter. And there's so much crossover with the opioid epidemic and the issues around helping people with opioid addictions, you know, and how that crosses over into HIV infections. Lack of adequate factual sex ed in schools, you know, and even, you know, there's just not that, you know, I mean, you see them in Chicago and New York, and you see bus station signs and, you know, about HIV, but you don't see them in other places, and you don't see them on TV, you know, and so it's sort of an out of sight, out of mind thing, because people aren't dying horribly quickly like they did. So the media, it's not a sexy story for the media anymore.
You'd written that you've kind of become a go-to person for your straight friends about LGBT issues, even beyond kind of questions about HIV, which is very familiar to me. And I guess my question is, what do you see as the most useful kind of straight allies can be in those kind of conversations?
Well, you know, I, like I said, I feel like my role is sort of this conduit between the two communities. And I had a friend whose son came out. I don't remember if his son was in college or high school. And he sent me a message and said, you know, I've had the safe sex talk with him, but I don't know anything about gay sex. What do I do? And so I asked my gay friends for, you know, suggestions, you know, so I was a go-between between him and my gay friends. And sometimes people are just curious, you know, and they don't want to say something in public that's wrong or offensive or whatever. They're just curious and they know that they can ask me and I'm not going to publicly shame them, you know, for asking a question. No one's going to jump all over them about using the wrong language or whatever, you know, and I can tell them, I can frame it for them, you know, in a different way. You know, and like I said, you know, it's just this opportunity to make that connection, I think, that's important. You know, it's whatever you can do to support your friends, straight or LGBT, is going to help them. And if that means that you advocate on their behalf, that's good. You know, that, you know, I can't say that LGBT issues are not my issues. They are, because they affect people in my family. They affect my friends, you know, the people I work with, you know, they affect the people around me, people I care about. So that's how I kind of frame it to people. It's like, you know, if you love your nephew, you'll support this, you know? Yeah. And I think people are just, when they react badly, it's because they don't know. They don't have personal experience. They don't have those, excuse me, those personal connections to people that they know of. I mean, they probably do, and they just don't know it. And because if they're not going to exhibit any signs of being welcoming, people are not going to be open with them. And it's, you know, it's just such a hard time right now, you know, because, you know, I have friends who have been beat up. I have friends who have been harassed. And, you know, and it's just because of who they are. Mm. And, you know, I just can't be quiet about that. And I think that if I can get other people to not be quiet about it, then that's a good thing.
Yeah. I was actually talking to a friend last night who's American and LGBT. And she was saying that the British government has added America to their list of, to our list of dangerous countries for LGBT travelers.
Yes.
And I didn't quite get it at first. And I was like, oh, well, you know, our government can maybe be a bit like overcautious in its travel advice. And she was like, no, Alice, like it should be on there. It's
I mean, we've fallen a long way in the last couple of years. And, you know, there was so much progress made when Obama was president. There was so much progress. And it was long overdue.
I think what you said about having everyone having different skills and being able to contribute in different ways is really going to stick with me, for sure.
Well, it's, you know, I thought that you had to get arrested, you know, you had to demonstrate in the street and get arrested or you weren't really doing anything, you know, and to be honest, I still feel that way sometimes, you know, it's like I do stuff and I think, oh, I should have done more. I should have done it better. I should have done it sooner. Should have done it this way. But that's not productive, you know, because I did do something. And if everybody does something, then you're not dependent on five or six people to get arrested to affect change. You know, it's, you can't keep deferring to other people to do it. There really are things you can do, whether it's making phone calls, even that, you know.
And my last question, I promise, this is something I ask everyone, to recommend another Dorothy who I should speak to.
Oh, I have three women.
Amazing.
To refer to. One is Nora Burns, and she does a one-woman show called David's Friend, and it's about her best friend who was gay who died of AIDS. Krishna Stone, who has worked at GMHC in New York for 25 years. And there was one more. Who's the other one? Trudy Ring, who's on staff at The Advocate in Los Angeles. And they're all straight women, and they've all been in the LGBT community forever. And they're all in the book. They're all in my book. And I have not seen Nora's show. I've seen Nora do a different show, but not that one. But it's all about her friend David, you know, and their relationship, their friendship. And it's just, it's beautiful. It's just beautiful.
They all sound awesome. Can't wait to speak to them.
I feel like the more I dig, the more stories, the more women's lives come to light. And I love that. Who knows where this will take us? So stay tuned for those Dorothys in future. See you next week.